The year is 1970. Under the buzz of high bay halogen lights, folding tables are set up in rows on the court of a school gymnasium. A young social psychologist named Henry Tajfel enlists a group of boys for an experiment. He asks the group to look at dots on a projector screen. "Estimate how many," he says. After delivering the responses, Tajfel discreetly tells each whether they overestimated or underestimated and split up the boys accordingly. In reality, the dot exercise didn't matter at all. The two groups were assigned randomly. Then comes the part that does matter. He asks each boy to distribute points to a pair of unknown participants, labeled only by group, overestimators or underestimators. To increase the stakes, the points are converted to money at the end. The pattern is immediate and eerie. Unaware of who was even in their group and understanding that they themselves didn't win or lose anything in making the decision, the boys funneled more points to their own group. Even employing a skewed point system where the total money paid out to everyone increases if you distribute some points to the other group, they sacrificed the increased total to give their side a relative edge. A trivial line drawn in an afternoon becomes a fault line. Put simply, people instinctively tend to act in favor of themselves and their group over the benefit of the whole. From experiments like these, Tajfel and later his student John Turner shaped social identity theory. We do not only hold opinions, we inhabit groups. We sort, compare, and identify. We favor us, we shade them. We derive pride, status, and security from the banners we carry, even if those banners were handed out 5 minutes ago in a lab. The cognitive gears are simple and persistent. 1. Social categorization. We label ourselves doctor, driver, renter, owner, black, white, coastal, or heartland. 2. Social identification. We feel the emotions of our camp and see the world through its narrative. 3. Social comparison. We evaluate our side against the other. Who earns, who deserves, who belongs.
There are general motivational or cognitive processes which one can conceptualize in relatively pure individual psychological terms, which, when triggered by some stimulus, some event, some state, purely psychologically defined, automatically and inevitably produces a hostile or negative outgroup attitude. Because the process is purely psychological, an individual psychological, and therefore unaffected by the social meaning of any intergroup relationship, of any social understanding of the relationship between in-group and out-group, it's inherently an irrational process. And indeed, in many respects, it can even be seen almost as socially meaningless or haphazard.
That was John Turner, who later became a professor of psychology at Australia National University. In this lecture on the concept of prejudice, he highlights the dangerous side of social identity theory. When the right switches get flipped, the human mind leans towards seeing them as a threat. We saw this in Levittown. We would see it again in a different form in the 90s and early 2000s, them to exploit. Give people a category and we will act like it's a tribe. Give a tribe a story and it will shape policy. Starting in the 90s, politics turned this lesson into scripture. As rhetoric sharpens, us becomes righteous, them becomes suspect and expendable. The result is a politics where policy details dissolve under team loyalty. If your group cheers, you cheer. If your group boos, you boo. Even when the scoreboard, wages, rents, foreclosures, says you're losing. This is how identity can bend an economy, how strategically exploiting an outgroup becomes acceptable. Identity became a fog thick enough to hide a foreclosure crisis coming straight towards us. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide.
Mr. Melby, do you think the line managers knew that loan originators were knowingly sponsoring mortgage applications that contain lies?
I think the answer is yes.
Families are not forming as early. There has been certainly a breakdown in what we would have originally called or conventionally called the nuclear family.
In our last episode, we traced the pivot from public responsibility to private reward. Nixon's break from the gold standard, the retreat from public housing, the rise of vouchers and tax favoritism for owners, the intellectual turn toward deregulation, and a landscape increasingly priced, packaged, and policed by markets. We watched the middle class flicker, the renter's safety net fray, and the idea of home morph into an investment product. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. Today, we'll dig into the 1990s and 2000s, the lead up to and impacts of NAFTA, the ripple effects from the dot-com bubble burst, how social identity helped sell a bipartisan crusade for ownership, how subprime lending surged, especially in communities long denied credit, how the machine of securitization spread risk until it became collapse, and how architects, planners, and investors reshaped cities under the banners of revitalization, new urbanism, and smart growth, even as affordability slipped away. We'll follow the political theater from Jack Kemp's Hope to Clinton's National Home Ownership Strategy to Bush's Ownership Society and ask, who actually owned the upside and who absorbed the fall? And we'll get into all of that after this break. Episode 6, The Fog of Identity. The 1980s didn't just bring new policies. They rewired the intellectual backbone of American capitalism. While politicians preached markets and deregulation, another force was shaping the worldview of the people who would run America's corporations, investment banks, and eventually its trade policy. That voice belonged to Peter Drucker. Drucker didn't speak in slogans. He spoke in frameworks. Born in Austria, trained in law and journalism, he arrived in the United States carrying a conviction that industrial capitalism was about to be remade. Not by government, not even by capital, but by management. He saw companies as social organisms. He warned executives that organizations get sick the way people get sick. And he pushed an idea that would shape global capitalism for half a century. Focus on your core competencies. Outsource the rest. It was the gospel of efficiency for a country being persuaded to abhor bureaucracy, regulation, and the hard work of shared prosperity. In the 1970s, Drucker's books, Management, Task, Responsibilities, Practices, and The Age of Discontinuity were required reading in corporate boardrooms. By the 1980s, his ideas were everywhere. GM, IBM, Procter & Gamble, the Business Roundtable, and the emerging class of management consultants who would become the unofficial technocracy of American economic life. Drucker wasn't pushing policy, he was pushing a mindset. And in Washington, a generation of lawmakers took note. One of them was Congressman David Dreyer, a rising California Republican with a pro-business streak and a Rolodex of corporate allies. Dreyer wasn't a student of Drucker personally, but he was a product of Drucker's world. Southern California had embraced the management revolution early. Defense contractors, white-collar service firms, technology corridors, and the booming Orange County corporate culture. Drucker actually taught just up the freeway at Claremont Graduate School, where executives flocked for his weekend seminars. Drucker's message was simple. Global competition is coming. The companies that survive will be the ones that reorganize, outsource, and transcend borders. For Dreyer, and for the California business community that backed him, it was rocket fuel. When the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, came up for debate in the early 1990s, Dreyer became one of its fiercest champions. He framed the deal not just as trade policy, but as modernization, a way to help American firms shed inefficiencies, expand markets, and stay competitive in a globalizing economy. This Drucker speak turned into congressional testimony.
Mr. Speaker, Teddy Roosevelt said that we have an obligation to support our president when he's right, and a responsibility to oppose him when he's wrong. Tonight, Republicans will provide an overwhelming vote for the North American Free Trade Agreement because Bill Clinton is right on this issue. On November 11th of 1979, Ronald Reagan announced his candidacy for President of the United States. In it, he envisioned a North American accord, one that would unite Canada, the United States, and Mexico. He did so because he believed strongly in free markets, in expanding opportunity for individuals, in reducing taxes, and creating greater political pluralism. Tonight, we are going to have an opportunity to do that here, to finally bring that vision to reality. Now, as we look at this struggle that has gone ahead, many people have been involved in it. Clearly, President Reagan envisioned it. This agreement was put together by President Bush and many people who worked hard there, and President Clinton supports it. This is the kind of bipartisan support that the American people want, and we can do it again on other issues. We have a great opportunity for the future, and I happen to believe that when the ideals of free markets, expanded opportunities are before us, we can support it. Vote yes on the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Dreyer wasn't alone. The coalition pushing NAFTA was almost a copy-paste of Drucker's disciples, Fortune 500 CEOs, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, tech firms hungry for integrated supply chains, and consultants trained in Drucker's belief that the future belonged to lean organizations with global reach. NAFTA shifted the framework of the American economy. According to the U.S. Trade Representative, this trade supported over 140,000 small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S. through cheaper supply and labor, or exports of their products to Canada or Mexico. Most economists agree NAFTA boosted the U.S. economy overall by increasing trade, but its effects were uneven. The bigger picture was that manufacturing left the U.S. and supply chains stretched. Productivity rose overall, but jobs didn't always follow. Between 1993 and 2013, the U.S. trade deficit with Mexico and Canada rose from $17 billion to $177 billion, contributing to nearly 852,000 displaced U.S. jobs. But the economist Gordon Hansen argued that far more jobs might have been lost to China without NAFTA. Ultimately, the effect was downward pressure on wages, and inequality, moderate through the mid-20th century, began to increase rapidly. The logic wasn't malicious. It was managerial. If a company's job was to be efficient, not patriotic, outsourcing was smart for business.
That it is absolutely impossible to make a financial person understand business. No. They believe that you make money. Hell no, you make shoes.
This is Peter Drucker, later in 1997, during a CEO forum hosted by Forbes magazine called Management Techniques in the Next Century. In front of a room of CEOs, he delivered this prescient warning about an overemphasis on shareholders.
Our owners, our new owners, will have to understand it in the form in which they can handle it. And so the governance of corporation, we are just beginning to tackle it. And let me see, so far, most of my friends in big businesses try to duck it and think they'll get away with it. They say out loud, we are running this place for the short-term interest of the shareholder. And with that mantra endlessly repeated, then try to do the right things. Well, one can fool most of the people most of the time. But I think we are getting to the end of this. I think we have to accept the fact that we have to get across that the interest of the shareholder, as expressed in yesterday's Dow Jones, is not what we are running our company by. Because if we did, we wouldn't have one very soon.
Despite his warning, the horse was already out of the barn. What began as Drucker's theory of efficient management, however short-sighted, became firmly rooted in the business world and spread into a political worldview. Government should operate more like a business. Be more efficient. Just get out of the way. Markets should organize themselves. The winners deserve their gains. The losers must adapt. NAFTA was the policy embodiment of that worldview, a bipartisan embrace of borderless capital at a moment when working class wages were stagnating, unions were weakening, and the foundation of the American middle class had been slowly dismantled. All for the bottom line, in service of the shareholder. And the consequences didn't stop at trade. They spilled into housing, global investment into real estate, upward pressure on land values, offshore manufacturing jobs hollowing local tax bases, and working class families pushed into more precarious forms of shelter and debt. By the time the housing market became the next frontier for, quote, innovation, the ideological groundwork was already set. Efficiency over equity, deregulation over guardrails, individual responsibility over shared obligation. A country managed like a corporation. And now, housing would be managed like a product. By 1990, home ownership plateaued around 64%. That number carried the weight of a national promise. For Black and Brown families shut out by redlining, covenants, and neighborhood stability codes, ownership was more than a deed. It was back pay on a stolen century. Politicians in both parties seized the symbolism, increased the home ownership rate, closed the gaps, and healed the nation's wounds with a key. But let's not kid ourselves. To maximize and squeeze that last bit out of the housing market, buyers needed to come from somewhere. There was a problem, however. Decades of exclusion meant many low-income families had little wealth for down payments and spottier credit histories. So the question became, how do you turn denied borrowers into approved buyers? In the spirit of, quote, compassionate conservatism, a philosophy that trusted markets, along with support from government, churches, and charities to uplift the poor, Jack Kemp, a professional football player turned politician, emerged as a housing evangelist. His mission was bold: put assets in the hands of the poor.
First of all, the economy has been through some very tough times. Interest rates have been very high. There's a direct correlation between high mortgage rates, high long-term interest rates, and the ability of people to afford housing. That's one problem. A second problem is the demographics of the country are changing. Families are not forming as early. There has been certainly a breakdown in what we would have originally called or conventionally called the nuclear family. I would say there are both demographic as well as economic reasons for it. It's a very small dip, but any dip is disappointing because really home ownership is at the heart of the American dream. And HUD and FHA and Ginnie Mae and the things I'm involved with, we all loosely put together as helping people to recapture the American dream. That is to own property, to own a home, and to get that first time home particularly. So I believe that in the Bush administration, we can change those figures, but nonetheless, it's a daunting challenge.
As HUD Secretary under George H.W. Bush from 1989 to 1993, Kemp pushed a pet project called HOPE, Home Ownership and Opportunity for People Everywhere. Like Margaret Thatcher, he sought tenant ownership of public housing units, a transformation from occupant to owner that he believed would save families and neighborhoods. He found a partner in Kimmy Gray, of the Kenilworth Parkside Resident Management Corporation, a D.C. pioneer of resident control. The rhetoric was revival tent powerful. Ownership would spark dignity, discipline, and responsibility. But turning distressed buildings into sellable assets required massive capital for rehab, deep subsidy, and careful governance, everything the politics of the moment wanted to avoid. Kenilworth Parkside never achieved broad tenant purchase, and the idea stalled. Yet Kemp's sermon echoed. You could hear it later, on the House floor, in campaign speeches, and behind the doors of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It aligned perfectly with American self-image. Opportunity if you reach. Ownership if you try.
Today, all across the country, I say to millions of young working couples who are just starting out, by the time your children are ready to start the first grade, we want you to be able to own your own home. All of our country will reap enormous benefits if we achieve this goal. Home ownership encourages savings and investment. When a family buys a home, the ripple effect is enormous. It means new homeowner consumers. They need more durable goods like washers and dryers, refrigerators and water heaters. And if more families can buy new homes or older homes, more hammers will be pounding, more saws will be buzzing, home builders and home fixers will be put to work. When we boost the number of homeowners in our country, we strengthen our economy, create jobs, build up the middle class, and build better citizens.
In the 1990s, the Clinton administration built a grand coalition of public and private entities around the idea of expanding home ownership. The National Home Ownership Strategy promised to, quote, target new markets and, quote, tear down barriers of discrimination. The path to do so was to push the government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to buy more mortgages from low and moderate income borrowers, enlist lenders with flexible underwriting, make a national campaign out of a moral goal. The instrument the GSEs found valuable was one that originally emerged in the 1970s, mortgage-backed securities, or MBS. See, a mortgage was historically held by an individual bank, a relationship between lender and borrower. Even with GSEs as a secondary loan market, loans were limited. Investors were a new way to expand the market, but the traditional one-to-one relationship was too cumbersome to engage with. So financiers developed a system for banks to sell their loans to aggregators who then bundled multiple loans and other assets into a single product that an investor could easily buy into like a stock. MBSs. Wall Street later developed more complex forms in the 1980s and early 90s, expanding securitization and establishing it as a major way to finance mortgages. But the financial industry still had its hands tied by the fallout of the Great Depression and rules intended to protect depositors. Here's where identity meets incentive. Banks and mortgage companies saw new customers. Wall Street saw new assets to package and flip. GSEs saw volume and political favor. and communities long denied loans saw an open door. Finally, someone saying yes. But a yes should have guardrails. And in the 1980s and 90s, guardrails, even prudent ones, were being removed, reinterpreted, or routed around. The SEC learned to blindly trust lending models. Private rating agencies wielded rubber stamps. Congress learned that the phrase market-based, a willingness to set limits for real estate loans by type and geographic market, could sell on both sides of the aisle. Then, in 1999, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act dismantled core protections of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which had kept investment banks away from everyday deposits to prevent speculation. Once those walls fell, commercial banks, investment firms, and insurers could fuse into financial giants. An open runway for the explosive growth of mortgage securitization. Unleashed, this amplified the market for mortgages, including the first wave of subprime risky loans. Lenders began pouring credit and home loans into neighborhoods that had long been shut out. Through companies like Long Beach Mortgage Company, Alta Residential Mortgage Trust, PNC Mortgage Corporation and PNC Mortgage Securities Corporation, Fleet Mortgage Corporation, Homeside Lending, Bayview Capital Corporation, Commercial Capital Bank Corp and its Commercial Capital Bank FSB, and Providian Financial. All companies that, one by one, would be absorbed into a ticking time bomb. Washington Mutual, a humble little bank that was too local, too friendly, too solid to ever imagine being considered too big to fail, but became one of the biggest players in the impending crisis. For generations, Washington Mutual was an institution that projected stability without arrogance, an accessible West Coast giant that many families saw as the opposite of Wall Street. And for a while, it was. Washington Mutual began in 1889, not as a bank chasing shareholders, but as a mutual savings institution, owned by its depositors, accountable to the people who actually put money in its vaults. Its mission was straightforward: help working families build a financial foothold. Mutuals were designed as the economic equivalent of a safety net and a ladder at once. No hedge funds, no exotic instruments, no games. That ethos carried Washington Mutual, WaMu as everyone eventually called it, well into the 20th century. Through depressions, booms, busts, wars, and suburban expansion, its identity remained civilized and steady. It was the kind of bank your parents felt safe recommending, the kind that advertised thrift, home loans, and community branches rather than yield spreads and arbitrage opportunities. WaMu was part bank, part civic institution, and in the 1990s and early 2000s, that reputation resonated especially deeply in Black and Brown communities. Washington Mutual wasn't perfect, but it branded itself differently: low fees, decent savings rates, a customer-friendly persona. For many families, it felt welcoming in ways other banks didn't bother attempting. I felt the appeal myself. I had banked with my family at Bank of America for years. But in 2002, as a freshman in college, I started managing every dollar on my own, and the rules and fees hit hard. Minimum balance charges, overdraft penalties, it felt like death by a thousand cuts. One afternoon, after finally deciding enough was enough, I walked into B of A to close my account. The branch felt like a dusty old vault, a relic of the 70s, dim, formal, brown, lots of brown, with staff sealed behind aftermarket thick glass. The teller coldly slid my remaining $600 through a metal tray without eye contact, like an automated transaction rather than a person. I drove straight to Washington Mutual. WaMu branches felt like the future. Open, bright, friendly. No bulletproof glass, no attitude, low fees, savings rates that helped your balance grow. In neighborhoods where banks could feel predatory or unwelcoming, WaMu felt like the opposite. Accessible, affirming, almost like it belonged to us. Modern, fresh, community-facing. For a lot of us, WaMu wasn't just a bank. It was a place where people felt seen. But while WaMu marketed itself as the people's bank, behind the scenes, it had been rapidly transforming. In 1983, it formally shifted from a mutual model to a publicly traded company. That pivot changed everything. A depositor-driven institution now had shareholders to satisfy, earnings to grow, and analysts to impress. One quarter's good performance wasn't enough. The line had to rise, quarter after quarter, year after year. And that transformation accelerated under CEO Kerry Killinger, who led the bank from 1990 into the 2000s. As you can tell in this upbeat promo, Killinger was ambitious and determined to turn WaMu into a national powerhouse. The Walmart of banking, he once said.
We like to think of Washington Mutual as a company that's focused on looking at financial services from the customer's point of view. And so some people have called us the unbank. I think that showed up for us with the launch that we did nationwide of free checking. For me, Washington Mutual is just a terrific institution that has been built with some great people over the years. And it has this underlying warm, open, friendly culture that values diversity, that allows people to kind of be themselves, and we have a good time. But it's also a performance-oriented culture, so it's very dynamic and driven.
Man in the middle there is Harry Kellinger ringing the opening bell.
We are always on the outlook about where is the landscape changing, where are the opportunities, how can we add value for shareholders by staying a little ahead of the curve. We went off and entered California with the acquisition of American Savings, which doubled the size of the company. Then Great Western, which doubled the company again. And then right on the heels of that, we did H.F. Amundsen. We're a growth company. We know we have to continually adapt, and we never accept the status quo. I tell our employees often that we have to totally reinvent the company within a five-year period. So if we look at anything like we did 5 years ago, that's probably unacceptable. The same thing for the next 5 years. I expect this company to look totally different 5 years from now than what it does today.
The path to that dream was aggressive expansion. WaMu went on a buying spree, acquiring more than two dozen banks, mortgage companies, and finance firms. Each acquisition brought market share, customer accounts, and critically, mortgage portfolios. Mortgages became the bank's lifeblood, and then its poison. By the time I opened my account with WaMu, Clinton's term had already come to an end, successfully increasing the U.S. homeownership rate. When George W. Bush took office, his administration continued the work, and by his second term, he pushed housing even harder. The Ownership Society became a centerpiece of his rhetoric, particularly ownership for minorities who had been locked out. Fannie and Freddie benchmarks rose again. Now, before we dig into how the crisis was supercharged, it's important to understand one other piece for context. The dot-com bubble had burst in March 2000, wiping out roughly $5 trillion in market value by 2002. To revive the economy, the Federal Reserve slashed interest rates, eventually reaching near historic lows around 1.2%. It was a stark contrast from the 1970s and early 80s. Back then, under Chairman Paul Volcker, inflation had crossed 11%, peaking at just above 14% in 1980. To combat it, the Fed raised rates dramatically, to a high of 20%. It worked, but at a steep cost. High borrowing costs crushed demand for cars and heavy industry, and the industrial Midwest never fully recovered. Between 1979 and 1983, the U.S. lost 2.4 million manufacturing jobs. Steel employment fell from 450,000 to 170,000, with remaining workers seeing wages drop 17%. Auto manufacturing was hit even harder, plunging from 760,000 workers in 1978 to 490,000 just 3 years later. So when the early 2000s arrived, the economic conditions couldn't have been more different. Low rates poured fuel on demand, the complete other extreme that would quickly overheat the economy. See, the Federal Reserve's interest rate changes how expensive it is for banks and big investors to borrow and lend money. Higher rates make them nervous, and they demand bigger returns on long-term investments for the risk. With low rates, they're willing to accept less of a return. Now, mortgage loans, being long-term investments, react to investor sentiment. Mortgage rates increase when investors demand a higher return. The rate falls when investors are willing to accept less of a return. So when the Fed's interest rate goes down, it should theoretically start a chain reaction that encourages everyone to lend and borrow money, eventually leading to cheaper mortgage rates. However, it's important to understand that with exceptionally cheap money in the system, inflation is soon to follow due to the amount of activity or demand that impacts labor and supply. Econ 101, when there's high demand, prices are bound to go up. Now, while this is all happening in the background, things really came off the rails fundamentally. Wall Street invents its most dangerous products, CDOs and synthetic CDOs, private label securities overtake government-backed ones, and subprime MBSs rapidly expand. Lenders, now overwhelmed with competition, fought to attract buyers through gimmicks that lowered monthly payments, interest-only, adjustable rates, low or no down payments, balloon features, and negative amortization. On the ground, mortgage brokers fanned out with clipboards and promises, pushing homes like a drug. People who were once denied access were aggressively pursued as part of a new game. Mortgage brokers just needed any loans to create more MBSs. Then, financing only required what was referred to as stated income and stated assets, where borrowers just had to declare the income and assets needed to get the loan without verification. This became an area of focus in later congressional hearings.
Where a stated income loan is one where the loan consultant asks the person how much they make and they enter that onto the credit application.
And there's no further follow-up of that number?
Correct.
When was that developed? It was during your period, Mr. Vanasek, is that right?
It preceded me by some period of time, mm-hmm. but it became a higher percentage of the loans over time as it became more market acceptable.
And Mr. Cathcart, why do you think stated income loans became a higher percentage of the loans that were being originated?
Well, as Mr. Vanasek said, it originated as a product for self-employed individuals who didn't have pay stubs and whose financial statements didn't necessarily reflect what they made. It was intended to be available for only the most creditworthy borrowers, and it was supposed to be tested for reasonableness so that a person who said that they were a waiter or a lower-paid individual couldn't say that they had an income of $100,000. I think that the standards eroded over time, at least I've become aware of reading all that has happened.
Right.
Standards eroded over time, and that it became a competitive tool that was used by banks to gather business, so that if a loan consultant could send his loan to Bank A or Bank B, the consultant would say, well, why don't you go to Bank B? You don't have to state your income. I do think, thinking it through, that there was a certain amount of coaxing that was possible from between the loan consultant and the individual, which would be something which would be invisible to a bank that that received the application, and the only test for that would be reasonableness, which as you've heard, there were some issues with in the portfolio.
Mr. Vanasek, how far up the management chain in Washington Mutual do you think they're aware that the percentage of stated loan incomes of people were engaging in what Mr. Cathcart said, and that more and more this was becoming a way to get around the rules in order to package as many mortgages as possible to then sell off in mortgage-backed securities?
I have to believe that given the long-term experience of the executives that they knew.
Mr. Cathcart?
I would say that all of the review functions were identifying that as a risk issue, and that therefore both senior management and the board was aware.
Mr. Malby?
I would agree.
Mortgage brokers convinced people that they were in a financial position to own a home. Communities starved of credit were suddenly overrun with it. From the President of the United States down to the local trusted experts, the message was clear and relentless. You can afford a home. The housing market began to feel less like an economy and more like a carnival. Bright lights, fast money, and no visible exits. The fear of missing out was a vortex, sucking in anyone within reach. Between 1983 and 2000, the share of subprime loans in minority communities leapt from 2% to 18%. Policymakers called it inclusion. Wall Street called it inventory. And for buyers, the pitch was intoxicating. Homes only go up. Get in now. This payment is temporary. Refinance later. If not, sell it to the next person climbing the ladder. On TV, flipping houses looked simple. In coffee shops and break rooms, people boasted about their second condo, their third investment property, the check they made painting cabinets and relisting a week later. Everyone knew someone suddenly in real estate. The home builder industry was drowning in demand. I've heard stories about the industry in the early 2000s. From offices to construction trailers, bonuses were handed out like party favors. Sales reps got new cars. Holiday parties swelled into champagne-soaked spectacles. Entire subdivisions rose from dirt in months. Stucco, granite countertops, cul-de-sacs with dirt yards and no trees. Some teams worked 70-hour weeks. Some marriages didn't survive the overtime or the parties. And behind it all, the institutional math made everyone feel invincible. If a borrower defaulted, the bank could just take the house back. Prices were soaring so fast, fueled by cheap credit and low interest rates, that even foreclosures penciled out as profit. Wall Street raked in fees, executives collected bonuses big enough to rewrite lifestyles. Designer suits, luxury SUVs, beach weekends, and rented villas. You could feel the mania in the air. Like static before a lightning strike. Everyone, at every level, believed they had discovered the cheat code to easy money. Until they didn't. Beneath the surface, there was a rot. Within each bundle of loans, they are divided into groups, or tranches, based on their level of risk or return. And the volume of risky loans only increased over time, mixing in with other assets to make them more acceptable. Banks paid off private rating agencies to assign the securities their highest rating, AAA. In addition, there were the collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, and synthetic CDOs, which essentially operated like a Ponzi scheme. If some loans defaulted, the most junior investor of that security suffered losses first. But again, these two were stamped AAA, at least at the top. Investors, pension funds, insurance companies, municipalities were all entangled into the game. The poison leached into every facet of the financial system.
Mr. Melby, do you think the line managers knew that loan originators were knowingly sponsoring mortgage applications that contain lies?
I think the answer is yes. We had certainly picked that up in several of our investigation reports through discussions through our independent investigation work.
The witness being questioned is Randy Melby, former general auditor at Washington Mutual from 2004 to 2009.
And then you think middle managers also knew that?
That information was communicated via the results of that work.
And how about the top managers?
The memos were also communicated upward.
Do you have any idea what the reaction was to that?
concerned. Specific investigation I'm referring to goes back to Senator Levin had referred to a request by an insurance agency relative to fraud. And so we had conducted an investigation back in issued, the report was issued in 08. Those results were very telling from the standpoint that we had this pattern of conduct that had been occurring for a period of years. Where limited or no action had been taken. So a report was addressed again up through executive management, up through the board.
This sounds suspiciously like fraud. I mean, if you know that you are selling a product that is not truthful, I guess, is this just caveat emptor, or is this something that could be considered in a let's play poor business practice.
Concerning, to say the least, yes.
Remember Toshville. We protect our in-groups. In the 1990s and 2000s, the in-groups were not just political parties or race. They were coalitions built around an idea. If your team was the home ownership team, skepticism sounded like heresy. Warn about predatory lending, you might be accused of trying to keep minorities out. Warn about systemic risk, you might be dismissed as anti-market. When identity hardens, policy hygiene weakens. Questions we should have asked about standards, enforcement, counseling, and concentrated risk were drowned out by the cheer of our own side and the boo from the other. Frankly, people at the top were also making too much money to care. Washington Mutual, through fevered acquisition, became one of the largest suppliers of home loans, subprime mortgages, option arms, zero-down loans. Formats once viewed as fringe or dangerous were recast as innovation. WaMu's mortgage subsidiaries became factories for these products, especially in low-income and minority neighborhoods where traditional financing had long been withheld. This was the tragic irony. The bank that had once represented access and trust became one of the biggest producers of loans designed to fail. Later hearings revealed that WaMu embraced a high-risk strategy, deliberately targeting borrowers without fully verifying income, assets, or repayment ability.
By mid-2005, the focus had shifted again to becoming more of a higher-risk subprime lender at exactly the wrong time in the housing market cycle.
This is James Vanasek, former Chief Enterprise Risk Officer at Washington Mutual from 2004 to 2005.
Washington Mutual was a reflection of the mortgage industry characterized by very fast growth, rapidly expanding product lines, and deteriorating credit underwriting. This was a hyper-competitive environment in which mistakes were made by loan originators, lending institutions, regulatory agencies, rating agencies, investment banks that packaged and sold mortgage-backed securities, and the institutions that purchased these excessively complex instruments. It was both the result of individual failures and systemic failures, fueled by self-interest, failure to adhere to lending policies, very low interest rates, untested product innovations, weak regulatory oversight, astonishing rating agency lapses, weak oversight by boards of directors, a cavalier environment on Wall Street, and very poorly structured incentive compensation systems that paid for growth rather than quality. One must also seriously question the wisdom of the elimination of Glass-Steagall and its impact on the securitization market.
Loan officers were incentivized to close deals, not evaluate them. And the securitization market rewarded volume, not safety. The old mutual bank DNA had been overwritten by the demands of modern finance. By 2008, it all collapsed. As introductory rates began to balloon, homeowner after homeowner defaulted. I saw family members swept up by the fall. Demand of new buyers couldn't keep up, so home prices dropped. Some that were upside down on their loans just walked away.
But the second change was that customer behavior also changed.
This is Ronald Cathcart, former Chief Enterprise Risk Officer at Washington Mutual from 2005 to 2008.
And we had a phenomenon which we had never seen before, which was that a buyer who bought a house that ended up being so-called underwater, where the house was worth less than the mortgage, actually stopped making payments. We first saw this in 2006, and what resulted is when you looked at the delinquency rates for a population of borrowers, you found that the high FICO score borrowers were delinquent at exactly the same rate as the low FICO score borrowers, which in theory was impossible. So it had the whole industry scratching its head. That phenomenon appeared about Q4 of 2006. In retrospect, what became clear was that in the past, borrowers would have first let their credit cards go, and the very last asset that they allowed to go delinquent was their home. This time around, it literally went in reverse, where it was deteriorating housing prices that caused the mortgage to go delinquent and the credit cards were preserved. And we actually saw that phenomenon in our credit card portfolio, where we found that people who didn't own houses had performance that did not deteriorate in the earlier stages of the cycle, whereas people who owned homes deteriorated. And that was completely counterintuitive. So these sorts of changes, when you throw them into an environment where there's an overdependence on FICO, results in really basically steering with the lights out.
Banks, stuck with depreciating assets, went bankrupt. Securitized risk became systemic contagion. The institutions that had bought the AAA tranches, pension funds, 401ks, insurance companies, municipalities, discovered that ratings weren't reality. Investors were unable to cash out. Banks failed or were forced into shotgun mergers. The global economy shuddered. Washington Mutual suffered the largest bank failure in American history. Regulators seized the institution and sold its assets to J.P. Morgan Chase for $1.9 billion, a fire sale price for what had once been a $300 billion-plus giant. Chase even retained property held by Washington Mutual. For customers like me, the shift was abrupt. One day you had a WaMu debit card. The next day, a Chase logo arrived in the mail. The personal bank that had welcomed so many was absorbed into a behemoth, yanking runaways like me back into the same rules, minimums, and fees I tried to escape. For communities that once saw WaMu as a partner, the failure was violating. It wasn't just a bank collapse, it was a collapse of trust. A familiar story in American housing and finance. An institution built for people morphs into an institution built for profit, and the people pay the price. Washington Mutual's story is a study in American transformation, how a mission can migrate, how incentives can mutate purpose, and how the system of finance can turn a community bank into a cog in a machine that ultimately devours itself. It's a story about what happens when the logic of shareholder value eclipses the logic of community value. And it's a reminder that in the long arc of American housing and credit, even trusted allies can become instruments of harm when the system rewards risk over responsibility. But the even colder part is, in the immediate aftermath, low-income Americans were the ones blamed for the crash. This can be explained by what is known as the frustration-aggression hypothesis, or frustration-aggression displacement theory, proposed by psychologists John Dollard, Neil Miller, Leonard Dube, Orville Maurer, and Robert Sears in 1939, described here by John Turner.
The frustration-aggression theory, or frustration-aggression displacement theory. A more accurate way of thinking about it for my purposes is the displacement theory of scapegoating. This is the notion, which goes back to Freudian psychodynamics, but was developed particularly in the 30s by Dollard and his colleagues, is the idea that for all kinds of reasons, people develop frustrations. These frustrations tend to produce an automatic instigation to aggress, and yet under conditions where the aggression cannot be directed against the real target, the real cause of the frustration, because either it may be unknown or because the real cause of the frustration is too dangerous, too powerful or unavailable, then nevertheless the instigation to aggress continues to build up. The drive to aggress continues to build up, and at some point it has to spill over. It has to be displaced. It has to go somewhere. And it goes almost in a haphazard way on some other target, some group who are not the cause of the frustration. So inherent in this notion, this frustration, aggression, displacement, the frustration automatically and inevitably produces aggression, and where the aggression cannot be directed rationally against the cause, it must go somewhere, becomes obviously an irrational psychological account of scapegoating. And that idea is still widely current.
Many politicians and pundits deflected and provided cloud cover for corporate finance, pointing their fingers downward rather than upward. Low-income borrowers, particularly Black and brown families who had long been denied credit, were cast as reckless buyers who should have known they were getting in over their heads. The narrative ignored the real engine of the collapse. Lenders pushing toxic products, Wall Street packaging them into poisoned assets, and regulators looking the other way. Instead of questioning the system that targeted vulnerable households, the system blamed its victims, and it was all acceptable because they were an outgroup. There was further salt in the wound. From 2003 to 2011, lower-income households lost about 74% of their wealth compared to 2003. While top-income households only lost about 19%. Retirement accounts evaporated, small businesses withered, families doubled up, moved in with parents, or watched their belongings set on the curb. We told a generation to buy into the American dream. Many did. At the worst possible moment, with the worst possible products, into the worst possible pipeline. And of course, again in crisis, opportunists rise. As foreclosures mounted, institutional investors moved in. Private equity funds, real estate investment trusts, new platforms backed by Wall Street credit. Portfolios of single-family homes, once too scattered to bother with, became scalable with new tech and cheap capital. Rent rolls replaced lawn signs. In some metro areas, entire neighborhoods tilted from owner-occupied to investor-owned within a few years. For families who had lost homes, this meant returning as tenants, sometimes in the same houses, but now with corporate property managers and market rate increases. The American dream was outsourced, then leased back. At the same time, for the multifamily market, deindustrialized districts were reborn as playgrounds of the high-earning knowledge economy. Warehouses became lofts, railside land became condos, coffee shops replaced corner stores. This had genuine benefits, less crime, more transit, better parks, but also a hard edge, displacement. Longtime renters priced out, cultural fabrics thinned. Postmodern housing tried to right modernism's sterility with cultural appropriateness, context, and play. New urbanism, championed by architects like Andres Duany and Elizabeth Platter Zyberk, preached walkable blocks, mixed units, and traditional streetscapes. Done well, it produced places people loved, but done at price points the market demanded, it often skipped the people who needed it most. Scholar Edward Glaser argued that zoning deregulation, allowing more density where jobs are, could lower costs across the board. He was right about supply pressure, but even where rules loosened, the price of urban land, the appetite of global capital, and the concentration of high-wage jobs often swamped affordability gains. Low interest rates in the early 2000s juiced housing demand. Alan Greenspan's Fed, criticized later for keeping rates too low for too long and for trusting markets to police themselves, helped inflate the bubble. When it burst, the Fed's successor stabilized the economy, but the recovery too was uneven. Asset owners rebounded faster. Renters and the asset poor lagged. Identity continued to sort and cloud the dialogue. Urban versus rural, owner versus renter, landlord versus tenant, YIMBY versus NIMBY, left versus right. Social identity can motivate solidarity, but it can also blind us to shared interests. The homeowner in a fire risk exurb and the renter in a flood risk basement both need insurance and infrastructure that works. The teacher priced out of her school district and the electrician priced out of his job site both need abundant, well-located housing. The retiree relying on home equity and the young worker drowning in rent both need stability without extracting it from someone else's future. When politics turn complex problems into team jerseys, we get symbolic victories instead of solutions. Blame circulates. Responsibility evaporates. Meanwhile, the math is unforgiving. Half of Americans earn $30,000 or less. 5% of landowners hold 3/4 of privately owned land. Construction costs climb. Labor is scarce. Land is expensive. Permitting drags on. We feel the strain in rent checks and mortgage quotes. Yet policy keeps circling around affordability instead of confronting it. Homeownership is stabilizing, but without guardrails, delivered through fragile loan products in neighborhoods with few choices, it becomes extraction, not empowerment. In the 90s and 2000s, we tried to close opportunity gaps through a system built to profit from them. The outcome was predictable, then painful, then quietly erased from memory. Identity helped sell the dream of ownership and drowned out the warnings. But identity isn't destiny. We can choose to look beyond our own lane and recognize shared interests. Instead of small, divided groups, we need broad coalitions, renters and owners, cities and suburbs, aligned around abundant housing near jobs with protections and public investment strong enough to support everyone. We need to expand the in-group until it's big enough to be called a country. In the wake of the Great Recession, a new normal emerged. Wages stagnant as housing costs continue to rise. Investors collecting second and third homes while workers are pushed out. The sharpest rise in inequality in a generation. We'll take a deeper look into how the system was saved while redefining who it served. How realtors framed falling prices as national crisis, fueled demand and fought principal reduction. Follow landlord empires and eviction-driven profits, and meet the financiers, tax breaks, and post-Citizen United politics that built the modern housing machine. Next time on Built to Divide.
Here was a company that made all kinds of unconscionable bets. Then when those bets went wrong, we had a situation where the failure of that company would have brought down the financial system.
Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's G-A-B-L, www.ronaldreaganmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, you can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.
Since we're going to the East Room next, perhaps its history will give you some idea of the evolution of a single room. The East Room was originally intended as an audience room, something like the throne room in European palaces, used for funerals, weddings, meetings with American Indians and other dignitaries. The East Room gradually became associated in the American mind as the place for the grand events in the White House. The artists made the East Room seem larger and larger and raised the ceiling higher and higher until it resembled the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. Here, from Leslie's chimney corner, the dignitaries of the Civil War are greeted by President Lincoln. Nobody smiles, and everybody but President Lincoln is frozen upright. The artist left a respectful amount of carpet showing. Mary Lincoln had spent a lot of money for the carpet, and her husband was angry. The center figure is Vice President Johnson. And this, the earliest photograph, is the East Room in President Johnson's time. When General Grant became President Grant, he put false elaborate timbers across the ceiling and furnished the room in a style crossing ancient Greece with what someone called Mississippi Riverboat. The predominant feature became three cut glass chandeliers. Under Presidents Arthur and McKinley, more and more potted palms were placed into the room until it looked like a jungle. This is the East Room, just before Theodore Roosevelt ordered his changes. Theodore Roosevelt's renovation. The rug, the timbers, and most of the potted palms were discarded. The room is simple and classic. Roosevelt used it for his state functions, and he once had a jiu-jitsu exhibition there. After Theodore Roosevelt, the potted palms came into the East Room once more, but there were no major changes in this room from 1902 to the present. President Truman raised the chandeliers and reduced them slightly in size.
Well, Mrs. Kennedy, this is the East Room pretty much as Americans have known it now for 60 years. Obviously, you haven't felt that you had to make any great changes in it.
No, I think it's lovely. I hate to make changes, really. So when you find a room like this, it's wonderful.